Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we look at the militarization of the police. With a little help from the corporate media, black intellectual Glenn Ford, and singer David Rovics. I hope you'll stay tuned. The cover of the New Yorker magazine last week was a striking depiction of the Ferguson, Missouri mass protests. An oil painting of a nighttime scene. People standing, hands in the air. New Yorker covers are almost always whimsical. When a cover shows a public event that took place far from the Hudson River, and when the artistic style is not whimsical, but striking and haunting, when they do this, you know that something really important has occurred. Following the events in Ferguson, the corporate media have at last begun to focus on the militarization of our local police forces. I respond to this media spotlight with my usual attitude. And, of course, my usual attitude is ambivalence. On the one hand, the militarization of the police is a real problem, and a growing problem, and it's good it's getting exposed. On the other hand, Ferguson reveals an even worse problem, which is the police murdering black people, and also mentally handicapped people, and other people they deem a nuisance or a threat to established power. Killing them with impunity, and beating others with impunity, or roughing them up, or stopping and frisking them without probable cause over and over again. Almost always when the police do this, they do it without repercussions, without even a scolding from the higher-ups. That indicates that they are acting this way with the approval of the established power. We need to explore the actual function of the police and every other institution. This is unlikely to happen, and if any sociologist does happen to do excellent research on the role of the police in the control of society, don't look for it to be mentioned in your local paper, let alone on TV's 6 o'clock dim witness news. So, reducing the complexity of the Ferguson events to a story of police militarization is to miss some of the worst parts of the story. But you can do worse still, and that is to reduce the topic of police militarization only to the issue of hardware. So even if we're talking only about police militarization, the important question isn't whether Officer Friendly in West Hartford should have a grenade launcher, it seems to me. The important question is whether the National Security Establishment should be training Officer Friendly to think of the town's citizens as enemies that need to be suppressed by overwhelming force. I'm going to get to West Hartford Officer Friendly's grenade launcher in a few minutes. Yes, he has one. I'll also get to the mine-resistant Army armored tank driven by his twin brother, Officer Friendly of Newington, Connecticut, next door. The tank was a gift from Chief Friendly of Manchester, just across the river. Manchester already had a tank, so it passed its second one on to Newington. Presumably, all three towns are quite jealous of the town of Stratford, Connecticut. Stratford police have their own Army combat helicopter. All free from the Defense Department. Are we all feeling safer yet? As I said, I'll get to the local police's new toys in a few minutes. But first, let's hear Glenn Ford of Black Agenda report. Ford argues pretty strongly that the real problem isn't just the wrong hardware for the policeman's job. The real problem is bigger than that. There's some audio distortion in the original recording, but please listen through it. Here's Glenn Ford.
The brave and besieged people of Ferguson, Missouri, have already caused serious complications for the U.S. national security state. By virtue of simply standing their ground in their own small city, the demonstrators have forced the local, county, and state police to show their true, thoroughly militarized colors. Ferguson's righteous agitators and rebellious black youth have succeeded in pinning down, in one small space, the armed forces of racist repression in full view of the corporate and the people's media, so that the whole world can bear witness to the truth of what another generation proclaimed nearly half a century ago, that in the black community, the police are an army of occupation. The military character and mission of the police is more clear today than when the Black Panther Party and others sounded the alarm in the 60s. Back then, the first SWAT teams were staking out sniper positions on city streets, and the Federal Law Enforcement Assistance Administration had only just begun to funnel millions of dollars in surveillance technology, guns, body armor, and all manner of lethal equipment to local and state police departments across the country. The term mass black incarceration had not yet been coined, but it was only a matter of time before a permanent, militarized police offensive against rebellion-prone ghettos would cause unprecedented numbers of black prisoners to flow into the greatest gulag in the history of the world. White America perceived that it was at war with black people, who no longer knew their place, and so places of confinement were made for them, fortified dungeons to house millions. Since America tells itself and the rest of the world that it does not make war on its own citizens, and that there is a sharp and constitutionally defined separation between the military and civilian functions of the state, the war against black people had to be called something else, a war on drugs, or simply a war on crime. Therefore, it was not long before the words crime and drugs and black came to mean the same thing, since really there was only one war going on, and it continues still. The young people of Ferguson and Greater St. Louis and all of urban, suburban, and rural black America understand perfectly well that war is being waged against them. The powers that be, every day of the year, make it crystal clear to black people, especially to black men, that an overwhelming and lethal force is prepared to crush them for any reason or for no reason at all. This is the definition of a war of terror. It requires the aggressor to engage in constant and ever-escalating displays of disciplined force, which is what militaries do. By refusing to disperse, the black people of Ferguson have compelled the police to flaunt their military nature and mission before the eyes of the world. The American national security state is embarrassed, but it will take a social transformation that is a revolution to disarm the beast. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Ford rightly notes that the big problem here is much worse than just the military hardware given to the police. But let's step back a bit and take a look at some of that military hardware given to the police, right here in Connecticut. Here's a piece from the Hartford Current, August 29, 2014, by Brian Dowling. I have condensed it a bit for radio. The headline is, Local Police Acquire Heavy Military Gear Courtesy of Pentagon Program. Here goes. The grenade launcher at the West Hartford Police Department was a gift from the U.S. Department of Defense. In Stratford, police have a Huey, a Vietnam-era combat helicopter. They got it at no cost beyond shipping and handling. In more than a dozen Connecticut towns, from Fairfield to Willimantic, the police now own armored military vehicles, supposedly for responding to active shooter situations and natural disasters. Quote, As the military gets the next generation equipment, they pass these down to law enforcement. When you don't have anything, the second generation is better than nothing, unquote, said West Hartford Police Lieutenant Ted Stoneburner. He added that the department's M79 grenade launcher is designed to launch gas canisters, not explosives. Police in Meriden and Woodbridge have them too. State and local police in Connecticut have acquired $12.9 million of military hardware through the Pentagon's 1033 program. Police departments in Hartford and Bridgeport claimed they had no inventory from the 1033 program. However, federal records show that the two cities were given $860,000 of the equipment. Some federal officials have criticized the use of military equipment by local police. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said on August 28, quote, "At a time when we must seek to rebuild trust between law enforcement and the local community, I am deeply concerned that the deployment of military equipment and vehicles sends a conflicting message," unquote. U.S. Senator Rand Paul called for the demilitarization of local police agencies. Nationally, the 1033 program has given more than $4.3 billion in equipment to state and municipal police departments since it began in 1997. In Connecticut, the program gave nearly 600 M16 military rifles to police. Also, 29 12-gauge shotguns, 32 utility trucks, 112 rifle magazines, 28 45-caliber pistols, 7 armored trucks, and 3 helicopters. Ranked by dollar value of the equipment, Stratford is in first place with its helicopter. Following Stratford are New Britain, Hartford, Watertown, Madison, and Windsor. Police officials say the heavy equipment can move tactical teams into and out of delicate, high-pressure situations. And having a vehicle that can take a few rounds is invaluable. Captain Christopher Davis of the Manchester Police Department, which has received an armored vehicle and a couple of rifles, said that the vehicle's presence can make a hairy situation easier to solve. Quote, "It can have an effect where it can de-escalate a situation because when they see the resources that are out there, outside a house, they may give up quicker," unquote, Davis said. Manchester was one of 11 Connecticut towns to request an MRAP, MRAP, or Mine-Resistant Ambushed Protected Vehicle. These vehicles weigh up to 24 tons, can transport 10 people, and cost about $750,000. Other towns with free MRAPs are Farmington, Hartford, Madison, Middletown, New Britain, Trumbull, Waterbury, Watertown, Willimantic, and Windsor. By the time Manchester's MRAP was approved, the town already had received a different armored vehicle through a separate federal program. So Manchester gave the MRAP to the Newington Police. Sidebar comment, I've lived in Manchester for nearly 20 years. It's a peaceful, large town, mostly middle class, with a population of 58,000. I read its local newspaper every day. Judging from that, Manchester's most prevalent crimes seem to be consensual sex with 16-year-old girls, leaving children in a parked car while shopping, petty embezzlement, and every once in a long while, an armed robbery at a convenience store. Protecting us from this bloody crime wave, the police force has acquired one army armored tank, and it gave away a second one. Back to the text. Local police agencies are acquiring armored vehicles and high-powered rifles at a time when violent crime around the state and the country is dropping, and departments are embracing a new model of community policing. The City of Hartford Police Department has received two armored vehicles through the 1033 program, as well as 35 M16 rifles, a shotgun, and more than 20 45 caliber pistols. The department acknowledges that the armored vehicles run against its vision of police officers as street-level public safety personnel. Quote, "It certainly does not play into our community policing model," unquote, said Hartford's Deputy Chief Brian Foley. So ends a nice article from The Current, written by reporter Brian Dowling, published August 29. But let's get back to Glenn Ford. His point is, the big problem isn't just that the police own M16s and grenade launchers and mine-resistant tanks. That warlike hardware is a symptom of the really big problem. And that is, the police is an institution, one of whose jobs is keeping the have-nots in their place by the use of force. Among the have-nots, young black men are most likely to be the target of this often lethal force. Let me say that I personally have never had a particularly bad experience with the police. With only one exception, police officers have always treated me professionally and courteously. I have no personal complaint to make about Officer Friendly. I'll note for the record that I am a 64-year-old white man who owns a modest house in a nice neighborhood, and I am practiced in looking, acting, and speaking with middle-class standards of decorum. Any police force that treats all its citizens as they have treated me deserves to be commended. And my experience may even be typical. But I'm afraid it's not universal. It is possible that, if I were a poor 20-year-old black man living in a poor, all-minority neighborhood, my interactions with Officer Friendly would have been rather different, as they were for the late Michael Brown in Ferguson, or the late Mark Duggan in Tottenham, London, UK, or the late Amadou Diallo in New York, or Rodney King in Los Angeles, or the late Chavis Carter of Jonesboro, Arkansas. Carter's case isn't so well known as the others. Let me tell you about Chavis Carter. In July 2012, Carter was arrested for an alleged marijuana offense following a traffic stop. He was 21 years old and black. The police frisked him twice, handcuffed him, hands behind his back, and put him in the rear seat of the police car. Carter then suffered a gunshot wound to the side of his head and died. The police stated that Carter's death was a suicide. Then the Arkansas State Crime Laboratory agreed that it was a suicide. How Carter managed to get his hands on a gun, and how he managed to shoot himself in the head with his hands cuffed behind his back, these remain two of life's little mysteries. Perhaps the late Mr. Carter was the love child of Annie Oakley and Harry Houdini. It's not just Arkansas, though. How about Portland, Oregon? Here's David Rovix.
Portland is a town that's in the news much of the time. There are a lot of vegans and there's very little crime. It's a nice, safe place to live. Folks ride bicycles a lot. The winters aren't so cold and the summers aren't so hot. They build houses out of cob. They hang out in the park, where you needn't worry about walking after dark. There are lots of homeless people, but they don't hurt no one. Just be careful of the boys in blue playing with their guns. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. You can hang out with the punks with the piercings and tattoos. You can eat out at a food truck, any neighborhood you choose. You can dance to Balkan music while you drink a microbrew. chilling in a gay bar with the mayor and his crew. But be careful what you do, be prepared to get some flack, especially for those who may be male, young, and black. The fact is you do better in Sweet Home Alabama. You're safer there on the old streets of Birmingham. Yeah, watch out for the cops. 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 There are flowers everywhere, but for others they've got prisons with some nice electric chairs. You can go downtown, ride the buses there for free, but you never know when you'll get a DWP. A town full of progressives, but such a rotten bunch of cops. Who knows who'll get shot at the next routine traffic stop? When you live in a place like Portland, where they tend to act this way, you can just join the police force instead of the KKK. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops.
David Rovix, from his 2012 album, Meanwhile in Afghanistan. Closer to home, here's another interesting Connecticut news item. I'm summarizing a news report by Daniel Tepfer from the Connecticut Post, August 26. A federal appeals court has ruled that Connecticut local police departments cannot claim immunity from lawsuits in a particular case. The decision grew out of a police SWAT team raid in 2008 that injured a homeowner in Easton and killed his guest. The police allege that an exotic dancer had said she had seen a small amount of cocaine in the home of one Ronald Terabisi. One night, as Terabisi and a friend were watching television in Terabisi's house, a heavily armed, multi-town 21-member police SWAT team smashed down Terabisi's door and tossed stun grenades into the house. They entered, pinned Terabisi to the floor, and smashed a gun butt into his head. Officer Michael Sweeney shot Terabisi's guest, Gonzalo Guizen, 6 times, killing him. Terabisi and Guizen were both unarmed. No guns were found anywhere in the house, and the police presented no evidence suggesting that the two men resisted the police in any way or intended to. Last February, the towns involved agreed to pay a settlement of $3.5 million to Guizan's next of kin. Ronald Terabisi, the homeowner, claims he now suffers from PTSD. He is suing the several towns for damages and for violating his civil rights. And the U.S. Second Court of Appeals has just ruled that the towns do not have immunity from such a lawsuit. Thanks to the Connecticut Post and reporter Daniel Tepfer for publishing one heck of a story on the drug war gone crazy. But then, it never really was about drugs, as Glenn Ford reminded us. And finally, here's part of an op-ed piece by the human rights activist David Love, published August 23rd in our own Manchester Daily newspaper, The Journal Enquirer. It's titled, Police Militarization is a Threat to Democracy. The killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the heavy-handed police tactics that have followed point to a growing problem in this country. The threat of a police state that endangers not only public safety, but democracy itself. After the fatal shooting of the unarmed Brown by Ferguson officer Darren Wilson, local law enforcement descended upon the city like an occupying force, complete with military weapons, tear gas, rubber bullets, and armored personnel carriers. Police assaulted peaceful, nonviolent protesters, arresting Antonio French, a St. Louis alderman, and tear-gassed Missouri State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. And police were hard on reporters, too, arresting several, confiscating the equipment from one of them, and even threatening to kill another. The militarization of the police is not unique to Ferguson. Thanks to a federal program called 1033, the government authorized the distribution of $4.3 billion in surplus military material to local law enforcement agencies, etc., 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 and the St. Louis County Police Forces brought a good deal of that stuff, including their MRAP, to challenge what were peaceful demonstrations in Ferguson. The piece goes on with many details about the 1033 program, and then it quotes a report from the American Civil Liberties Union. The report is titled War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. And it says that federal programs provide police officers with wartime weapons and tactics, which they use disproportionately on communities of color, and with no public debate or oversight. Most of the assaults are drug raids on people's houses. Quoting again from the ACLU report, the militarization of American policing is evident in the training that police officers receive, which encourages them to adapt a warrior mentality and to think of the people they are supposed to serve as enemies, as well as in the equipment they use, the report says. And it goes on, and the article gives some more details of St. Louis County law enforcement agencies and the St. Louis City Police Department and others have received counterterrorism training by the Israeli National Police and the Israeli Defense Force, which have years of experience occupying Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and suppressing their rights, says David Love, the author of the piece. Love concludes, police are community servants, not mercenaries, and when they view the community as a wartime enemy, then we are truly approaching a police state. We must demilitarize the cops now. And I must say goodbye now. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Please check out our archive of past broadcasts at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum. Support your local alternative media, and please come back again next week. Ciao.